Good afternoon, Your Honors. If it pleases the court, my name is Robert Kendig, registration number 7527. As the court knows from the briefs, this appeal involves a question of the adequacy of an award of maintenance and child support. And we know going in that as to most of the issues before the court, the standard is abuse of discretion. And we understand that that is a significant standard. However, for three reasons, we think that we have shown the court in the briefs and can show the court that discretion was abused here. And those reasons are, first, the trial court basically, despite its own factual findings about lifestyle, simply ignored those findings and awarded to the wife and mother who had the children 80% of the time, 70% or 75% of the available, 25% of the available family income, and awarded to the husband who had the children only every other weekend, 75% of the available family income. Secondly, the court's factual findings, and we are relying primarily on the court's factual findings, it's not a question about disputes in the evidence, the court's factual findings were heavily influenced by its express reliance on a hypothetical questions asked to our expert, to which he gave truthful answers, but none of the hypotheticals related to the facts of the case. Some of those errors were noted by the court, but nevertheless, in the court's decision, it still relied heavily on that hypothetical question and the answers to it. And finally, the court expressed a quite remarkable hostility, if you will, or disagreement with the fact that the parties were living, the mother and the children were living in Vail. The father's employment, he worked approximately 3 days a week, was in Denver. And that was established by an agreed parenting plan, which had been approved by the court prior to trial. The children were attending a private school. The court expressed disagreement with that, despite the fact that the private school was provided for in the parenting plan and had been agreed to by the parties. So that, in summary, is the factual basis for the argument.
Excuse me, counsel. The court said the husband was paying 77% of the private school. Is that correct?
Ultimately, that was the order, yes.
Yes.
That's correct. And actually, that's an important point, Your Honor. It's a very important point because the judge was acknowledging, if you will, that he had made the very order that we are complaining of. He acknowledged by making that order of 77% of the private school and 77% of uninsured medical expenses and 77% of agreed extracurricular activities that he had kept 77% of the income. It was actually a little bit less than that, maybe 75%, with the husband, who hardly had the children at all, and left 25% with the wife. The court made a finding that the wife's expenses with the children were $30,000 per month. There was no objection to that level of expenses. There was no argument, nor was there any finding that that level was in any way unreasonable given the lifestyle of the parties. Notwithstanding that, the court, even imputing $3,000 a month of income to Mrs. Brandt, ordered only $13,000 per month, $10,000 maintenance, $3,000 child support for her support. So the court basically said, you will live at a standard below what you have been living at, even though we're not going to find that your standard was unreasonable. And then if we take Dr. Brandt's sworn financial statement, which was Exhibit A in the case, he showed expenses of $40,000 a month, but he even assumed that he'd be paying $15,000 a month support. So his own expenses, including his expenses of a Denver apartment and a place in Vail, were $25,000 a month. So the court left him with more money than he needed for his living. So we believe on its face, the 75-25 split under the circumstances of this parenting plan, which was agreed and had been approved, in and of itself, it shows that the court abused its discretion. But beyond that, to get there, the judge relied on a hypothetical question where counsel asked our CPA expert, well, assume this level of income on the part of Dr. Brady. Well, it was the wrong level of income. He actually was found to be making $5,700 per month more than that. Well, assume that the wife can make $70,000 a year. The evidence was that she couldn't. And in fact, the court found that she couldn't. Assume child support of $5,000 a month. Well, that wasn't what it was. Assume an equalization note of over, I think it was $560,000. It ended up being $300,000. And yet, in paragraph 30, I believe it is, of the findings, the trial court relied on that hypothetical question. And finally, I think I've already covered that the court assumed that the parties would not have had they stayed together, enough money to continue both being in Vail and in Denver. Consequently, said, well, they probably would have moved to Denver anyway, and by the way, their expenses are going to go down, so my order is reasonable. And yet, the court made no finding as to what those expenses would be. Simply said, well, this is what I'm going to award, notwithstanding finding that $30,000 was a reasonable level of expenditures for this family. The last issue is not an abuse of discretion standard. The last issue is whether the trial court should have imputed to Mrs. Brand the level of income that it did. And the evidence was undisputed, and the court found that Mrs. Brand had been employed as a real estate broker, and that was the only employment she had ever had during this marriage. The evidence showed, and that's...
Excuse me again, counsel, the evidence shows that she did not have any income during the period of time she was a real estate agent.
Only during this last couple of years, at the time of the divorce, the evidence was that she had income early in the marriage when she'd worked in that field. But on that point, Your Honor, the evidence was that the wife had not earned any income. Actually, however, she had sold the party's residence, which was a $4 million house, so it actually saved the parties $250,000 in a commission from one sale that she had. So there was evidence she had been working, there was evidence that she had been selling. She testified quite extensively about clients she'd seen, places she'd shown. And the court found, and this is in paragraph 30, that because of the downturn in the economy, those were the court's exact words, because of the downturn in the economy, she had not had any other sales. But notwithstanding the fact that the court did not blame it on her or say that she was shirking, which is the standard for finding that someone is voluntarily underemployed under the Martinez case, notwithstanding the fact that the court found that her lack of sales were due to the downturn in the economy, the court said, well, I question her good faith in this process.
Is the statement that there's the court questioned her good faith?
Yes.
Is that equivalent to a finding that there is no good faith in terms of a choice?
It was not entirely clear. I think the court said something like I don't want to take the court's time to find it, but I don't think the court came out and said, I find that she did not act in good faith. But the court nevertheless did mention good faith, did question it, and I'm sure it will be argued that the court made a finding she did not act in good faith. But at the same time, rather than say if the court made a finding she didn't act in good faith, it also made a finding the only reason she hadn't made any sales was because of the downturn in the economy, which seems to be contradictory.
Can't you reconcile that by saying there are certain times when one employment choice, as opposed to the other, is not good faith based upon the acknowledged downturn in the economy?
If that were true, and perhaps under certain circumstances that would be true, but if that were true, then every time, because of a downturn in construction or real estate or whatever, someone was on a temporary basis not making any money, then automatically they would have to go into a new profession. And that was the situation here. The statute talks about temporary employment, And while her employment as a realtor was not intended to be temporary, certainly her lack of income was intended to be temporary. Further, she had sold the party's residence, so she was working on that. I don't think there was sufficient evidence under the Martinez case for the court to have found that she acted in, did not act in good faith, because the Martinez case requires a finding that she was, quote, shirking. And in the face of the fact that she had sold the party's residence, that seems hard to find. I would like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. If it pleases the court, I'm Ron Litvak, and to your counsel table, working on the briefs with Natalie Simpson, an associate in my firm. I represent Scott Brandt, the appellee, in this matter. We believe that the legal standard is pretty clear with respect to the first two issues that Ms. Brandt has raised on appeal. There is no dispute that the abuse of discretion standard is an important and time-honored standard, and it helps us get to finality in divorce cases. It helps us get to a resolution of cases that doesn't involve a second guessing by someone other than the trial court judge who's sitting there to observe the demeanor and the behavior. And this is a case that involved significant additional factors, such as the geographical distance and how Dr. Brandt was going to be able to meet the need to work in Denver and be able to have time with his children in Vail, which I believe that Mrs. Brandt would like you to see as a fault-finding enterprise by this trial court judge. I don't believe Judge Anderson was involved in any fault-finding at all. He was simply looking at both philosophically and practically how these parties were going to be able to meet their respective needs and what was fair to do with their income. And if you will, I believe it was very much a supply-side analysis that looked at how much income is available and allocated it according to the available resources. When the court made the findings that Dr. Brandt's income was approximately $65,000 per month and made the finding that Mrs. Brandt had an earning ability of approximately $3,100 per month, it set up the beginning of that analysis. From there, the court looked at the net income that was clearly available and had ample evidence from two different accountants and the net spendable income analyses that had been furnished to the court by the appellant's own accountant. All of which demonstrated that the income, net income, based upon that level of gross income, was about $34,000 to $35,000 a month that Dr. Brandt would have available to him. So the court went through an exercise of saying, out of that money, I'm going to allocate it at $6,000 that he's going to have to be able to pay in order to provide for a timed payout of the property division, another $10,000 that's going to be monthly maintenance, another $3,000 for child support, and another at least $2,310 a month for tuition for the children to be able to attend the Vail Mountain School. When you go through adding those amounts up, it's over $21,000 a month. Plus, over and above all of those amounts, Dr. Brandt was required to pay health insurance for the children at a not inconsiderable rate, and was required to pay 77% of any of the other activity expenses of the children. These were formidable amounts. These amounts, just by doing the math, left Dr. Brandt with about $13,000 a month to live on. They left Mrs. Brandt and the children with significantly more to live on. And that's not even considering the use of the $6,000 a month, which was sort of the deferred transfer of property, which, based on the case law, properly, Mrs. Brandt should not have to spend in order to meet her needs. But even without consideration of that amount of money, Mrs. Brandt had more available net resource than Dr. Brandt. So when Mrs. Brandt argues the 75-25 split, you can only get to that kind of a number by starting with only gross income, not factoring in the significant tax burden that someone in a very high tax bracket in the United States of America has to pay, and ignoring all the evidence on those facts presented by Mrs. Brandt's own witness. So I don't want to spend too much time on that argument, but I think something else that bears argument is this sort of a notion that a hypothetical that I posed to the accountant for Mrs. Brandt in trial should be used as a basis for saying the judge committed error. When I posed a hypothetical to the accountant, it was a hypothetical based on all of what Mrs. Brandt was asking for from the court. It wasn't based on the court's actual order. It was there to show the court how absurd her requests were. That if at the end of the day, the court did what Mrs. Brandt was asking the court to do on the questions of property division, on the questions of maintenance, child support, and payment of Vail Mountain School, what Preston Hofer, the accountant for Mrs. Brandt, testified was it would leave Dr. Brandt at the end of the day living on approximately $3,500 a month. This was based on his own numbers. Now, Mrs. Brandt also wants to urge this court that the hypothetical involved the sum of $600,000 a year, and the court ultimately found that Dr. Brandt's income earning ability is $669,000 a year. Well, first of all, I don't think that that's a significant number when you're looking at a 10% variance in income. But bigger than that is that this would be invited error by the accountant because his own hypothetical used $600,000 a year for income in the exhibit that he provided and was admitted at trial. So all that occurred there is that there was an analysis of his own work that then considered different income, the amount of maintenance that was being sought by Mrs. Brandt, the amount of child support that was being sought by Mrs. Brandt, the amount of Vail Mountain School coverage that was being sought by Mrs. Brandt, and the amount of property division payments that were being sought by Mrs. Brandt to determine and show the court that at the end of the day, if the court did what Mrs. Brandt was asking for, Mrs. Brandt would have $22,000 a month to live on, plus all the property division money that she'd be setting aside each month. Dr. Brandt would have $3,000 and some dollars a month to live on, to show the court that based on someone who's out there earning over $55,000 a month, that it would be an absurd result. And the court agreed that it would be an absurd result for a case. So the court went through and did something that was not absurd. It ordered a very formidable amount of maintenance, $10,000 a month. Now, Mrs. Brandt wants to argue to you that there was no argument about her $30,000 a month budget. First of all, there was. There was a lot of testimony about the unreasonableness of her au pair expenses, which she thought were very economical and asserted as much, only to admit on the witness stand that she was incurring over $2,700 a month for au pair expenses for children who were, at the time of trial, closest ages 13 and 11. And these were the kinds of expenses that were brought out as being unreasonable.
The court made no findings like
that. No, but I don't think the court had to. I think the court, again, looked at the budget and said, even if this were a $30,000 a month budget, I can't meet that budget. There's not enough available income to do that. I have to look at what available income there is and provide for an order that says that each party is going to have a reasonable amount of the available resources that are created by predominantly Dr. Brandt's income. And I think the court did that. The court leaves Dr. Brandt at the end of the day for the next 6 years, about while he's paying off a promissory note, with approximately $13,000 a month out of the $65,000 a month he starts with. The court order provides for Mrs. Brandt to have $10,000 a month maintenance, whatever she's able to earn, $3,000 a month child support, and most of the Vail Mountain School expense being paid for by Dr. Brandt. Health insurance for the children taken care of. She winds up with more cash than Dr. Brandt does. So this notion that there's somewhere a 75%, 25% division of the income is simply not supported by the evidence and not supported by the court's award at all. I want to get to the third argument in this case, the one that deals with the notion that the court was not able to impute income to Mrs. Brandt. Mrs. Brandt went to trial not arguing as the other spouses who've been voluntarily underemployed in the published cases of the courts of appeal in the state. Not like them at all. Either in those cases, either all four cited cases by Mr. Kendig involve someone who's either in school, improving an educational capacity to be able to go out and obtain increased income, or has a job and the other spouse is arguing that the spouse who has this job should be earning more. That's true for all of those cases. One or those, the other of those facts is true for every one of those. Neither is true here. Here, Mrs. Brandt isn't getting education. She's not doing anything to improve her earning ability. She's simply not earning any money. And Mrs. Brandt doesn't have a low income. She has no income. And frankly, it's worse than that. Mrs. Brandt's sworn financial statement indicates that she's spending in excess of $900 a month of business expenses to be able to generate no income. It's costing more than $11,000 a year for her to have no income. The court had to impute some level of income. The court had significant evidence in front of it, and not the least of which was Mrs. Brandt's own testimony. When asked the question, if somebody would say that you could make $70,000 a year, would you say that you should go do that? And she said, I could make at least that doing real estate. We've cited it in the record, so I won't go back over it, but it's at pages 301 and 320 of the record. That Mrs. Brandt specifically, in her own words, says, I'm in real estate because I can make more than $70,000 a year. She actually says more than $70,000 a month, but I'm assuming that she meant $70,000 a year. So the analysis there with respect to, first of all, Mr. Hofer, the accountant's hypothetical, is sort of setting up a straw man argument. This is not the Mr. Hofer was working off of what Mrs. Brandt was asking the court to do, and all that hypothetical is intended to do and did do is show just how absurd that result would be to the court, to Judge Anderson. Then we get to the third argument, and there is a de novo review requirement with respect to the court's application of the law, but I do agree with what was implied in the question that was asked of Mr. Kendig, and that is that this court did in fact make a finding that is tantamount to a shirking finding. When the court specifically said, it does appear that it does not appear that she has made an effort to explore work opportunities in the field of her educational training. When the court said that in light of the fact she has made virtually no income in the last few years in real estate, in light of her lack of effort in seeking employment in a field such as hotel management, is surprising and disappointing. As such, she appears to be voluntarily underemployed. And there's more. That's just a sampling from the court order of the things that Judge Anderson said that definitely show that he found that it was, as he concluded, a less than good faith effort to earn money and a less than good faith career choice at this point in her life. Mr. Kendig would argue, and did argue in his brief, that while the court trial court questioned the wife's good faith, it is without doubt reasonable for a spouse to continue what she has been doing throughout the marriage. I would disagree with that statement. If somebody is doing something that's not remunerative and doesn't make sense for a short period of time, that's one thing. But to do it throughout the entirety of the marriage and then to argue that because I've been doing something that makes no sense for a long period of time, I should get to continue doing it, that argument makes no sense. What's being relied upon is other areas of family law where there is a status quo ante type of situation, where we look to what the standard of living was or the status quo ante in the marriage and trying to graft it onto choices being made by one spouse that bear on nothing related to whether that spouse is making appropriate choices. And in fact, if anything, tell us exactly the opposite. That if you're making that bad a choice for that long, for that many years, then it's more and more evidence that you are in fact not making a reasonable choice and you are shirking your responsibility to go out and earn some income. The court made a very reasonable finding. In fact, it was against Dr. Brandt as to what that level of income was, based on Mrs. Brandt's own testimony that she felt she could earn in excess of $70,000 a year. How could anyone other than Dr. Brandt be arguing that the court made a finding that she was only capable of earning $37,500? Unless there are other questions, I've discussed the matters that I wish to discuss. Thank you very much for your time today.
Good.
seems as though we find ourselves still facing the argument that the numbers aren't what they are. I will go through the numbers. The court found that Dr. Brandt made $55,000 per month. The court ordered $10,000 maintenance and $13,000 in support. That leaves Dr. Brandt with $42,000. Yes, that's true. There are tax obligations. And $10,000, according to Mr. Hofer's testimony and everyone common knowledge, $10,000 of what he pays is tax deductible to him. He pays no tax on that. So he has $42,000, she has $13,000. She then pays taxes on her $10,000. She supposedly, at least according to the judge, has $3,000 worth of income. The math is very clear, and on that point, the judge was absolutely right. He left Dr. Brandt with 77%, Mrs. Brandt with 23%. And if you add in the imputed income and so forth, it becomes pretty much closer to 75-25. But we're still hearing that argument. With regard to the question of his work in Denver and his expenses in Denver, first, the court made no findings as to what additional expenses there were. However, those expenses were already on Dr. Brandt's sworn financial statement. So when he had $42,000 left, and he showed on his sworn financial statement $25,000 per month, less his maintenance and support obligations, including those expenses, he had enough. He had plenty. With respect to the question of what Mrs. Brandt could earn, she testified, yes, absolutely she testified, that she could earn more in the real estate business, which was why she was staying in it. Not that she could earn more today, but she said, I'm making a good in. In so many words, I am making a good faith career choice because I want to be able to earn more in the future than a desk clerk in a hotel or a concierge or whatever the employment expert said that she could do. That's all. She was making an effort to earn as much as possible. Granted, she wasn't doing it that year. Finally, with regard to the question of the court's findings that I just heard argument about, I would challenge anyone to find detailed findings analyzing exactly what income was there and how much was available and what the expenses were. The findings were quite lengthy, but there is no such analysis. The only analysis of what income was available were the findings in the hypothetical, which were not entirely based on what Ms. Brandt was asking for. They were based on allegations concerning income that proved incorrect, and very significant allegations concerning Mrs. Brandt's current earning ability, which were not correct. And so they were considerably distorted, and the judge did rely on them. If anyone has any questions, I would be happy to answer them. Otherwise, I believe I've covered my materials. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you both, counsel, for your arguments this afternoon. This case will stand submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course.